Take care of everything.
Check everything. Welcome to the Minute by Minute podcast on Awake. Today we have a special guest with us, Varun Sunny, Dean Varun Sunny, I should say, and really we'll be going through Varun's experiences today. So it's a special focused on Varun. So welcome, Varun.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you very much for being here. And Varun, when I was thinking about introducing you, you have such an illustrious career already. And, you know, if I can say, you're still quite a young guy. So I was thinking to myself, I could probably spend 5 or 10 minutes going through all the long list of achievements and accolades that you have. But in summary, I can say that you're, you know, an extremely accomplished individual, being the Dean of Religious Life at the University of Southern California. I would urge any listeners to jump on the USC website to read more into the background of our guest today. But I think it's 5 degrees now you have, is that right, with the highest being a PhD? So,
you know, I have 12 physicians in my family, so none of my degrees mean anything to any of them. I'm not a real doctor. So no, yes, it looks good on paper, but it doesn't, I'm not the dean at home. Let's put it that way.
Well, you know, I can emphasize that my fiance she's a doctorate. She's passed she got her PhD last year. So I lived through that moment with her. So I understand the willpower that you would need to have had to get 5 degrees. It's quite a powerful thing.
And yet my daughter still says, when I grow up, I want to be a real doctor like mama, not like you. you can only go so far, you know.
So you can tell your daughter this, actually. Back 200 or 300 years ago, I think it was the physicians that wanted to be called doctors.
Hey, that's good.
Yes, so it was always the academics.
Oh, this is, you've given me some serious ammunition for my next family dinner. So thank you for that.
You're very welcome. I've heard this story many times from my fiance, who likes to remind me. So she is the official doctor, and the medical doctors are just copycats. So you can share that story around. But, you know, I was reading through, you know, your history, and what struck me was that you were born in India, raised in Southern California, and you have family on 5 different continents, and collectively they represent every major religious tradition in the world. And what popped into my mind was Yogananda's teaching on environment versus willpower, and how he says that you need to be careful about your environment because often it's stronger than your will. So that then led me to think, I wonder how much of Varun's environment and this background of having family all over the world from different religions contributed to your life and what you went on to do.
Yeah, thank you for that. Such a great question. I think it is fundamental to who I am. That doesn't necessarily mean that everyone who has this experience will go in a particular direction. I'm the only one, like I said, in my family who studies religion. I have 12 physicians. My brother and sister ostensibly had the same nature and nurture as I did, and yet they took it in a different direction. But I do think that if not for the way I was raised, I would not be doing the work that I do. And that is actually because of my grandfather. My grandfather was the primary sort of influence in my life. He lived with us, and his mother, my great-grandmother, was very close with Kasturba Gandhi, who was Mahatma Gandhi's wife. And so my great-grandmother used to go to jail with Kasturba. She used to be one of the leaders of the sort of women's division of the Indian nationalist movement. And my grandfather used to regale me with stories about Gandhi growing up. He was a little kid who was running around sitting on Gandhi's lap while he was giving talks. And so my own struggle to understand what it meant to be Indian American, I felt was fundamentally rooted in a idea of Gandhiism. And that was, I think, especially important when I grew up in the US. I'm the child of the 1965 Immigration and Naturalization Act. For basically 40 years, Indians could not immigrate to the United States from 1924 to 1965 to naturalize as citizens. There was a period of Asiatic exclusion. But after 1965, if you were a physician or an engineer from India, you could immigrate. That's how my parents came. That's why everyone I was raised with was a doctor or an engineer. It's not that every Indian is a physician or engineer, even though that's what I thought growing up. It's that only physicians and engineers could immigrate to the United States. And so that was the context we had. We had no one in the public sphere. We had Apu from The Simpsons and Deepak Chopra, and that was it. So we didn't know what it meant to be Indian in the United States. Around when I was a kid, the movie Gandhi came out, and we went as a family to see Gandhi. And for the first time, I saw my own story on a big screen. And suddenly I began to see Gandhi as a way for me to be Indian and American, because like Yogananda, Gandhi had a universal sort of perspective. He did, like Yogananda, learn from the different religions of the world. He did, like Yogananda, think about how we transform ourselves in order to transform the world. He did, like Yogananda, think deeply about the different paths to knowing God, whether it be Gyan, whether it be Bhakti, whether it be Karma, whether it be Raja. And of course, he was initiated into Kriya by Yogananda. Gandhi is my kind of bridge to Yogananda. But I think the reason why Yogananda was such a powerful figure, is such a powerful figure in my life, is because the kind of universalism that he sort of represents. And I was just there yesterday. It was my mom's 70th birthday. We took her to the Lake Shrine, the Self-Realization Fellowship in Los Angeles, Pacific Palisades. We did a blessing for her at the site where Gandhi's ashes are. And it felt like I was coming full circle, because we were surrounded by the monuments of the different world's religions. And that, to me, was like my dinner table, because like you said, I have an Indian family. That means my family represents the traditions of India. India is the largest Hindu country in the world, the largest Jain country in the world, the largest Baha'i country in the world, the largest Zoroastrian country in the world, the largest Sikh country in the world, the second or third largest Muslim country in the world, with significant Jewish and Christian populations. And so just by looking like India, my family represents the religions of the world. And so I wonder if Yogananda could have had this message of a church for all faiths if he wasn't Indian, because there is something that is part of an Indian consciousness, and I would say specifically a Hindu consciousness, that is all paths go to the same place, but you know, everyone has their own path. It is not a universal truth claim. It's different strokes for different folks. It's your religion is as good for you as my religion is as good for me. It is pluralism before we had the word pluralism. And so I do think that Yogananda represents a universal perspective that in many ways is grounded in a Hindu pluralism. And that's me. I was raised Hindu in the United States at a time where I struggled to understand what it meant. Gandhi and Yogananda helped me think about Hinduism as a open source protocol for liberation. And my own family became the laboratory where I was able to see those relationships flourish.
Epic. And, you know, it kind of, I think the guys that joked, you know, should I go there, being Northern Irish, you know, there's quite a bit of, religious spotlights, you know, in society with the Protestant and Catholic side of things. What's your take on the Protestant and Catholic setup?
Well, I'll say something about religious conflict in general. And that is that I think most people think that most religious conflict happens across traditions. So I think the general narrative out there is religious conflict happens between Hindus and Muslims, or between, you know, in Sri Lanka would be Buddhists and Hindus, or Muslims and Christians, or Jews and Muslims. But the reality is that what we see in Northern Ireland is actually the predominant story of religion. Most religious conflict happens within religion itself. It happens within Christianity, like we see in Ireland. It happens within Hinduism, like we see in India. It happens within Islam, like we see in many Muslim majority countries, right? And so I think that what we see is that traditions aren't monolithic, that there's as much diversity within each tradition as there is between traditions. I mean, if there is one Christianity, why are there 30,000 denominations, right? Why are there 30,000 different perspectives? It's because there are many kinds of Christianities, there are many kinds of Hinduisms. What I think that means is that we should all feel empowered to interpret our traditions in a way that makes sense to us. The act of being religious is an act of interpretation. I think we are raised with the idea that we inherit these traditions and we have to preserve these traditions, but no one preserves the traditions the way they inherit them. If we're not reinterpreting the traditions, then they won't make sense for future generations. The religions we know about today, we know about because they're open to interpretation. And so the ones that weren't open, we don't know about. Our texts that endure are malleable. They're open to interpretation. And so when you see religious conflict, you realize that there's not one way to be religious, especially when that conflict's happening within the tradition itself. And that we all should feel empowered to creatively interpret texts in a way that makes sense to us, because we're doing that anyway. No one can live the Bible. What is the Bible? Is it an eye for an eye, or is it turn the other cheek? What is that? It's both, actually. The way you read the Bible tells you more about yourself than it does about the Bible. The Bible is a mirror to who you are, just like the Vedas, just like the Quran, just like the Guru Granth Sahib, just like the spiritual classics. And so I think that when we see conflict, we should feel like we don't have to replicate that conflict. We don't have to inherit that conflict. We don't have to perpetuate those stereotypes that may have led to that conflict. We can reinterpret our traditions in a way that get us past that.
Mm-hmm. You know, It's just a comment. I was going to say, listening to you speak there, I was thinking about how would you address and how would you speak to somebody who was in conflict? And but you already answered my question, so thanks for that, Vernon. Awesome, Frank.
Yeah, Vernon, you mentioned the inclusive nature, I suppose, of your own interpretation. Sorry, your own interpretation of the scripture that you mentioned. And in Yogananda, we see a quite inclusive approach. So you'll take branches or large branches of the Bible and Christian thought and Christian mystics, for example, and really include them within the scope of one, you know, approach to God. And he did that with a lot of the other faiths and the other philosophies. How important would you say that is, that approach is in today's society?
I think it's critical. I think Yogananda was operating on two levels, and we can learn from the way he was operating. The first is he knew he was coming to the West, and he knew that he was going to predominantly be speaking with Christians. And so he talked a lot about Christianity. He taught a lot about Jesus. He learned the tradition of the culture that he was then bringing other ideas into. And he used the tradition of the culture to introduce new ideas. He used Jesus to introduce yogic and Vedic ideas. And so in many ways, he was a brilliant translator. He was very strategic about that. But I don't think he was cynical about that. I don't think he was using Jesus to get to more people. This is actually who he was fundamentally. You don't write a 2,000-page volume on Jesus or Christianity if you're cynical about it. You write it because it's actually who you are. And so when you go to like the Lake Shrine, you see Jesus on the sort of up Jesus's image next to all the gurus, next to Krishna. And I think that was very, very deliberate. And so what can we learn from Yogananda about this? I think we can learn that there are many different kinds of literacies, and that if we're talking about cross-cultural communication, we're talking about 360-degree thinking, we're talking about how we engage across difference, then we have to understand the perspective of the difference of the person we're engaging. And Yogananda did that work. He was the first person to really come from India as a Hindu missionary, as a Hindu saint, I would call him, and set up in the US, not with the idea of doing a lecture and going back. You know, Vivekananda had come, others had come, but they'd always gone back. Yogananda came, he stayed, he was committed to being this translator. And the fact that, you know, the Self-Realization Fellowship is growing still, it's one of the only monastic orders in the world that continues to grow, and it does it without a visible leader, I think is testament to his idea that at the end of the day, you have to know the details about sort of the different cultures and people you're engaging on the one hand. And on the other hand, you have to hold as a fundamental truth that there is something that connects us as human beings. So even though he knew about Christians, Muslims, Buddhists, and Hindus, he came back to universal truths that connected Christians, Hindus, Muslims, and Buddhists. And some of those truths are the truths of seeing yourself in each other, seeing God in each other, and serving God by serving each other. That's a truth that most religions can sort of support and get behind. And he invited people into the conversation by the way he used language, and by the way, he used his literacy across the faith traditions. And so that's what I try to do at USC. At USC, I oversee more religious groups than anyone in the country. I oversee almost 100 religious groups. I oversee more chaplains than anyone in the country. I oversee over 50 chaplains representing every faith tradition. We even have a humanist chaplain for atheists and agnostic students. And so we're super inclusive, but I take my cue from Yogananda. I try to support students in the specificity of their faith traditions, but create a framework for understanding how we're all connected. And I think that sense of how we're all connected has never been more important than it is now. Because now we're in a social media age where the differences are amplified, but the similarities are muted. And we can live in these echo chambers where we never have to engage difference. And so I think if Yogananda were to see that, he would probably be disappointed that a new technological landscape that could talk about unity is too often focused on division.
Varun, you mentioned Yogananda as being a translator, and maybe he's also like a mediator between the, the different faith groups. But in your own experience at USC, you talk a lot to young people, and you are pretty close to, I would say, the pulse of time. How would you say is the state of things there? Is it like, is all lost for the future? Or is there a youth out there that is willing to compromise and see the other viewpoint and see a kind of a great vision?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I think there's something that keeps me up at night, and there's something that gets me up in the morning. Let me tell you what keeps me up at night. What keeps me up at night is that I have seen over the last 10 years of doing this work, a full-blown mental, emotional, and spiritual health crisis for young people. It gets worse and worse every year. The rates of depression and self-harm have doubled amongst college students in the last 9 years. 65% of college students in the United States will tell you they're so anxious that they're having trouble functioning. 65%, that's normal now, that's baseline. What it means to be a young person is to be anxious to the point of non-functioning. 1/3 are wrestling with depression, and 10% have contemplated suicide over the last year. On a campus of 50,000 students, think about the numbers that I see. You know, it's overwhelming. And it gets worse, and it gets worse, and it gets worse. And I think there's a few reasons for that. But at the heart of it, what I find is at the heart of the mental, emotional, at the heart of the mental health crisis of anxiety, depression, and suicidality is a spiritual health crisis of loneliness. Our students are really lonely. Their social media is actually antisocial. Long before COVID took them away from each other, their phones took them away from each other. Our students are the first digital natives in human history. They've compared their real life experiences with the Instagrammed, idealized lives of their friends their entire lives. Their entire lives, everything they look at tells them they're doing something wrong, that everyone's figured it out but them, that they don't belong. And that sense that they don't belong has led to an enduring crisis of loneliness. It's not just me. This medical company, Cigna Health, did a survey, and they found that the loneliest people in the United States right now are not the eldest, but the youngest, and especially 18 to 22 year olds. What does that mean? The loneliest people in the United States right now are college age students, right? And so this is what keeps me up at night, that we have a generation in crisis. This is a generation that is largely, almost majority now, 50% unaffiliated with religion, as opposed to 2% of their grandparents. So they don't have the same meaning-making structures or frameworks to think about their place in the world, or an ethical framework in which to engage the many challenges that their generation faces. And so that's what keeps me up at night. What gets me up in the morning, though, is that this is an extremely empathetic generation. They care a lot about each other, way more than my generation cared about one another. This is a generation that was raised with the idea that you shouldn't bully one another. This was a generation that's raised in a social justice environment, a generation that isn't going to stand for environmental degradation, isn't going to stand for police brutality, isn't going to stand for income inequality or the abuse of animals. And so it's a generation that is really determined to solve, to name, to frame, to interrogate the problems that they're facing today. Here's my overall concern about this, is that as they try to change the world, as previous generations have, they don't have the same kind of spiritual community that previous generations had. My great-grandmother was part of the Indian Nationalist Movement. The Indian Nationalist Movement was an interfaith movement, a multi-faith movement of Hindus and Muslims and Sikhs and Buddhists and atheists and Jews and Christians who all came together around a common goal. My wife is from South Africa. She was raised under legalized racial segregation. She grew up under apartheid in an Indian-only neighborhood until she was 18. My family in South Africa was part of the anti-apartheid movement. The anti-apartheid movement was also a multiracial, multi-faith movement of Muslims and Christians and Buddhists and Hindus, etc. The American Civil Rights Movement was a multi-faith spiritual movement grounded in love of people of different faiths. And so if we have a social justice movement that is not grounded in love, that is not grounded in spiritual community, that is not grounded in an ethical framework that brings people from different perspectives together, my sense is that young people are going to burn out. They need each other, and I don't think they have each other. And that's the fear. So what does that all mean? It all means in this context that the teachings of Yogananda have never been more important, because the teachings of Yogananda don't require a faith identity. The teachings of Kriya Yoga give, I think, students tools without requiring a particular perspective or on God or text or tradition. What I love about Yogananda's teachings is he embraced the idea that spirituality is a science that can be tested over time. It's a spiritual technology. The reason meditation exists is because it works. We have 3,000 years of testing, retesting, hypothesizing, and confirming. It is the scientific process. This idea that somehow spirituality is different is just not true. That's a very Western idea. But in India, it's the same thing. There is no difference between religion and science. It's a way of being, living, and seeing the world. It's empirical. You test it. If it works, then you do it. If it doesn't, then you don't. And I think students who desperately need tools for meaning-making, contemplation, and the ability to generate a kind of internal resiliency could really benefit from Kriya Yoga practices that in many ways can be secularized in the way that mindfulness and yoga have been secularized, to offer non-religious students tools that help them thrive. Now, this is a controversial sort of thing that I've just said. The purists would say, we can't do that. You can't offer yoga or mindfulness outside of Hinduism or Buddhism. That what you're doing is you're flattening a complex tradition, that you're not honoring the context, that yoga was never about flat abs. It was about the liberation of one soul. And that when you put it in that context, you're basically essentializing, stereotyping, and demeaning a 10,000-year-old Vedic tradition. I think that's an interesting intellectual argument. I don't have the luxury of an intellectual argument as the chaplain, because I see students who are dying every week because of suicide and accidental drug overdoses, students who are desperate for meaning, making, connection. I will try anything to help students, regardless of whether it's been secularized or not, taken out of context or not, or offered in a way that the purists might not appreciate. And listen, as a professor, I get it. I get the idea that what we're doing is a type of spiritual colonialism where we go in and mine different traditions and wrap it up in sort of white privilege and sell it to the masses. Fine, but I need that, because I need something to help students who are really struggling.
Very interesting parallel. You know, at the start of this conversation, you mentioned that you've got a family of physicians, but yet you're only a scientist. You know, you're only a historian in your PhD or your doctoral analysis. But here you're talking about, you know, at the start of this dialogue, you mentioned the link between spiritual, mental, and emotional illness. And here you just talked about the kind of the cure or the supporting package for those ailments, which really are the cause of a lot of physical ailments as well. And I just love how, you know, at the start you said, oh, my family don't like that. They don't call me a real doctor, but look, this is the truth, isn't it? This is how it can impact your physical health and emotional health as well.
Yep. They're all connected, right? Stress causes inflammation. Inflammation causes disease. And our kids are super stressed out because they have no cosmic perspective of meaning making. We think they're stressed out because they're anxious and depressed. And so we have to sort of pathologize anxiety and depression. But they're stressed out because they don't feel like they're part of a larger whole. They don't feel like things are beyond just transaction. They've been told, do this, do this, do this, do this, and you'll have the right life. And they've done all those things and they don't feel like they have the right life. They've been told that, you know, if they're able to get the right degree, the right job, the right this, the right that, then everything will be right. And that's not the way they feel. And so they themselves have feel like they've been sold a raw bill of goods, and that has a really negative physical health impact. But like I said, and I, you know, obviously I have a perspective here. I'm the dean of religious life, but what I see is that here's what we know. We know that if the data tells us that if you have an intergenerational spiritual experience growing up, that means if you go to church, masjid, gurdwara, temple, whatever, with your parents or grandparents growing up, then you are 80% less likely to experience depression as a young adult. 80%, this comes from the book, The Spiritual Child, by a professor at Columbia University named Lisa Miller. And I asked her about this. I'm like, this data point can't be right. She said, no, trust me, I've triple, quadruple checked this, it's right. And so now we're at an age where more than half of our students haven't been raised with an intergenerational spiritual experience. And we have unprecedented anxiety and depression in young adulthood. So what's the solution here? You know, I think we have to reimagine what a spiritual life looks like for young people. And in the absence of that, we're going to have trauma and tragedy. Now, that doesn't mean we have to reimagine what a theistic life looks like. It doesn't mean we have to reimagine what God looks like. But we have to equip young people to be able to answer the questions of who are you? What does your life mean? How do you find significance? How do you translate your values into action? What do you want? How do you know what you want? Who is the you that thinks they know what they want? No one's ever asked students any of those questions before, and it's to their detriment.
Varun, you seem to, you know, you've got hundreds upon hundreds of students, I'm sure, over the years that have come to you for counseling, and you know, you've provided advice to, I'm guessing their age group is in the late teens, early 20s, but what do you think about getting them earlier? And in the in Yogananda's life, he had the How to Live Skills, and yeah, it was in the documentary Awake. You know, what's your opinion on the How to Live Skills? And
yeah, I almost feel like when I get them in college, it's too late. I do what I can, but I sometimes feel like I'm just reshuffling the deck chairs on the Titanic. You know, it's almost too late, right? We know that 80% of cognitive and emotional development happens before the age of five. And so the things that our kids will never remember are the things our kids will never forget. They will actually fundamentally shape who they are. So much of therapy, for example, is just unpacking what happened in your childhood, right? And so I do think it's too late by the time they get to college. Here's what I love, though, is that at least in the United States, at least in LA, I see elementary schools and high schools becoming much more self-aware about this crisis. And at an earlier age, they're bringing contemplative practice, gratitude, joy, awe into the curriculum. You know, my kid in preschool learned how to meditate and do yoga. I didn't send her to a Yogananda school. I sent her to like a Hollywood, it was very much like a Hollywood school, almost like a celebrity school. And they just taught yoga. It was a Montessori school, but they just taught yoga and meditation. No one pushed back. Everyone loved that. It was part of the curriculum. It wasn't like you opted in. And I would tell my kid, I was like, oh, you meditating? No, Papa, I'm doing silent observation. I'm like, well, that's even better, quite frankly. I'm not sure what the difference is. But at the end of the day, we are getting better. I think you'd see that even in the UK. There's a lot happening in the UK. There's a minister of loneliness who has talked about loneliness as a public health crisis and is now reverse engineering what that means for young people. And so, yes, we have to, in many ways, reimagine education. The art of living school of life kinds of models that Yogananda pioneered, that also Rabindranath Tagore pioneered, are the models, in my opinion. That kind of goes back to even what the ancient Greeks were talking about, which is, what is the art of living? They called it eudaimonia. Eudaimonia is human flourishing. The goal of education was human flourishing. The goal of education wasn't like get the job to pay down your debt. You know, 40% of my students are finance majors. 40% of my students don't dream of finance as young kids. Why are they finance majors? Because my university costs $75,000 a year to go to. And so you have to get the job to pay down the debt, but that's not the promise of transformational education. And if we think about what the promise of transformational education is at an earlier age, and we build into that model, that paradigm, that pedagogy, emotional intelligence as well, then I think we're going to have better outcomes by the time kids get to college.
You, before the call started, mentioned about your involvement in Awake. Maybe you could just tell us how you actually became involved in making the documentary.
Yeah, you know, it was sort of just fortuitous. My dear friend and colleague at the University of Southern California, Lisa Lehman, who is a brilliant documentary filmmaker. Well, she's also very much someone who is a student of the Vedic tradition. I mean, she's really knowledgeable, both, I think, I don't want to speak for her, but both from a professional and a personal perspective. She also did the documentary called Crazy Wisdom, which was about Chogyal Trungpa Rinpoche, one of the founders of the Naropa Institute in Colorado. And so she and I had sort of met on that project, and she knew how much Yogananda meant to me. And so it was pretty easy, actually. You know, we were just on campus one day and we just filmed something in the church, and so it worked out. So I'm not sure if I would have been involved if I didn't know the filmmaker, but I'm glad I did, because it was really fun to be a part of this. When I did do this documentary and when it came out several years ago, you know, first of all, it's a beautifully, beautifully done documentary. It looks so good. The production value, the voiceovers, I mean, it almost feels like what a mystical experience might feel like. And so she's obviously a brilliant filmmaker. But what I loved about this process is that when the documentary came out, I got emails from people all over the world. I could see how this documentary really impacted people on a fundamental level. I could see a community that I didn't quite see before that was connected around this documentary. The community of SRF came out and really supported this film, and it had theatrical screenings all over the world. It had a theatrical screening in my hometown in Newport Beach. It was like the one time my parents weren't disappointed that I didn't go to med school is when they took their friends to see me on their home screen. And so as I do this podcast with you, I am aware that, listen, this is years later and the documentary is still creating these conversations around the world. So I guess it was fortuitous that I was a part of it, but for me it was enlightening to be a part of it because it showed me what spiritual community looks like.
You mentioned Lisa knew how much Yogananda meant to you, and hence she had no hesitation in involving you in the project. Please describe to our listeners what Yogananda currently does mean to you in your life.
Yeah. So, you know, listen, I was raised Hindu in the United States, like I said, at a time when there weren't a lot of Hindus. And I was raised in Southern California. And so Yogananda was my guy. Yogananda was Hindu American in Southern California. Like, he was the paradigm. Right now, I probably have the most visible interfaith position in Los Angeles, the Dean of Religious Spiritual Life at USC. It's the only job of its kind in the city. And the city is the most religiously diverse city in human history. So I have the most visible interfaith job in the most religiously diverse city in human history. And I teach a class called Global Religions in LA. And so I am deeply connected to the city of LA. I'm deeply connected to the many different religious traditions and communities. And I teach it, you know, and I take students all over on field trips. And to this day, like, my favorite sacred space in the city of Los Angeles is the Lake Shrine itself, SRF. That is my spiritual home. There are other Hindu temples, but that's the place I feel most at home. Why? Well, it doesn't look like the traditional Hindu temple that my parents might have gone to in India. We have those. There's one in Malibu that's beautiful. It doesn't look like even the ISKCON temple that I was raised in, the Bhakti temple, which I love. But once again, that could be a temple that you could go to in any city in the world. ISKCON temples are very similar in every city. The Lake Shrine is something unique in and of itself. There is nothing in the world that's quite like it. Yesterday was my mother's 70th birthday, and her 70th birthday wish was that we go to the Lake Shrine where she could get a blessing with her grandkids and her kids. And so as a family, just 24 hours ago, I was standing at the Lake Shrine with Brother Satyananda, who oversees it. And he gave us a blessing at the place where Mahatma Gandhi's ashes were buried. There it is, the full circle. You know, my family, a Gandhian family, my mother, an immigrant of this country, on her 70th, as she's looking over her Hindu American life, to be at that place to get that blessing in the presence of Gandhi's ashes in Southern California, which is our second home. So it just, the question to me isn't, you know, why does he mean that so much to you? The question to me is, how could he not have meant that much to you? You know, I don't know if I had a choice. He was just there for me when I needed him.
In the documentary, I think you appear three times, and you know, you do speak very, very powerfully, and when you're here, I guess, you know, it would be remiss if we didn't, you know, talk about some of the content there that, that you were involved with. And one of them was the death of God and reconceptualizing the divine was how you put Yogananda's mission, really. But what to you is the reconceptualization of the divine or God in this instance?
Well, I think what Yogananda taught us as Westerners that is very intuitive as Hindus is that God is within us, right? That namaste, right? The divine within me acknowledges and salutes the divine within you. That that divinity is a reflection of a larger divinity. That to serve God, we serve each other. That the way to find God is to look inward, not outward. That's where Kriya comes from. That's where contemplative practice comes from. It's not an outward journey, it's an inward journey. To me, that reconceptualization of God, which wasn't reconceptualized from a Hindu framework, but reconceptualized within a Western context, is one of his great legacies in the West. And what I think he encouraged people to do is to, I don't think Yogananda was in the business of proselytizing or conversion. What I think he inspired people to do is to find the God within them from the faith perspective of their own faith traditions. What does it mean to be Muslim and see the God within you? What does it mean to be Jewish and see God within you? What does it mean to be Buddhist and see the potential for Buddhahood within you? What does it mean to be an atheist and see the potential for goodness within you? That empowering act of looking inward, coupled with tools that help you look inward, you know, to me is how we reconceptualize God. That God isn't out here, that God is in here, and that you can access God firsthand. I mean, that's what mystics have told us for a long time, but Yogananda gave us the tools to understand what that really meant.
This kind of sounds like a very universal message that is not polarizing at all, but oftentimes, I feel like sometimes it's a problem of labeling, because when especially young people are confronted with religion, they take a stance that they are more skeptical. But when they hear about spirituality, they go like, oh yeah, that sounds interesting. Maybe we can do that. And do you feel like this kind of message, like, because you mentioned this science versus religion before, do you think this could be, and I believe fundamentally that those two need to be married up again. Like, do you think maybe spirituality and science can be married up again into something that is like a philosophy for the future for young people?
Yes, I think in India, that's just the way people are raised. I think in the West, you said it right. I think it can happen in terms of integration of spirituality and science. I don't think in the West it can happen in terms of an integration of religion and science. And this is an important, I think, semantic distinction. 50% of our students say they're not affiliated with religion, but 75 say they're spiritual, right? 75%. So most students will say they're spiritual more than they're religious, or that they're spiritual but not religious. And so I think the word religion can be a negative trigger for a lot of students. And that word can preclude them from engaging in a spiritual practice that can actually be helpful to them. And so, what I see with young people is that they walk away from religion because they're walking away from the institutions of religion. Not because they're walking away from the teachings of religion, right? They're walking away from the institutions of religion because they have distrust on those institutions. They feel like those institutions have not lived up to their values. If you're a 20-year-old, what have you seen of religion? Terrorism, anti-LGBTQ rhetoric, patriarchy, casteism, other kinds of religious violence, conflict, the covering up of child abuse, right? All of those things have happened in religion and have been institutionalized in some way or another. So of course, young people will look at these institutions and say, you preach love, you say God is love, and all we see is violence, all we see is subjugation, all we see is oppression. You know, young people were raised with the idea that if it bleeds, it leads, it gets the front page, and if it bleeds in the name of God, it's the front story. Like, they're not raised with stories about liberation theology, about religions funding hospitals and orphanages and social services, about religions who empower young people, about religions who are against LGBTQ violence or casteism, etc. those aren't stories that ever sort of get into the public sphere, even though those are also stories about religion. So they get one side of religion and they're turned off by the institutions. I don't think they're turned off by the teachings, but they throw the baby out with the bathwater. And so what I think Yogananda can offer is a understanding of a universal spirituality. The Dalai Lama talks about this a lot, as well, a secular set of values or ethics that we can, a universal responsibility that go beyond the dogma or institutions that they're rejecting and move towards where what they're looking for, which is a sense of meaning and purpose in the world. And here's, I think, a good example of that. We know meditation has been something that has brought its practitioners a sense of joy, a sense of release, a sense of meaning. But only now, over the last 20 years, do we have the data to prove that. Suddenly, we have a science of mindfulness that proves what we've been talking about for hundreds of years. We have a science of joy. We have a science of gratitude, a science of prayer, not a spirituality. Finally, the science has caught up to the spirituality. We're able to prove the things via science that Yogananda had already known, always talked about. I think what we can do is now integrate the research and the spirituality around these themes, contemplation, joy, awe, gratitude, prayer, as opposed to around perspectives, Hinduism, Islam, Christianity, Buddhism, et cetera. And so I think if we're gonna get to an integration in the West of spirituality and science, it has to be spirituality with a big S, all encompassing. It has to be about the human experience of meaning making and not the denominational or theistic perspectives within the different traditions. That's gonna turn students off.
Are you, Varun, are you doing any research or are you helping coordinate any research in that area?
Yeah, we are. You know, we're running massive mindfulness and yoga programs and sleep programs. We trained 10,000 people last year in mindfulness program, probably another 1,000 in different yoga practices. And now we've brought on researchers from the Children's Hospital of Los Angeles, which is a premier hospital, research hospital in Los Angeles, who, if you now go through one of our mindfulness or yoga classes, we collect data. And the classes that we're offering for free now are also data sets for our researchers to prove that what we're offering for students helps them with the things they need. They're telling us they need help with sleep, anxiety, you know, substance abuse, depression, and friendship, right? And so we teach a class now on friendship, and we can't keep up with the demand. And it's a pretty, you know, basic class, like class one, eye contact, class two, you know, asking good questions, class three, you know, follow up. Like, these are things that aren't, you know, they're things that my kid learned in kindergarten, and yet we're teaching them in college, and we can't keep up with the demand, right? And so I think that this is kind of the school of life approach that Yogananda was talking about, the art of living approach that Yogananda was talking about. In many ways, when we're teaching classes on friendship, we're teaching classes on what it means to be human, because what it means to be human is to be in community and to have a tribe. And if we're teaching classes on what it means to be human, then we are teaching classes on spirituality. And so I see all of this as a kind of covert spiritual education. You know, it's a class on sleep, but it's really a class on who are you? It's a class on friendship, but it's really a class on meaning making. It's a class on yoga, but it's really a class on contemplation. There's misdirection that we can use to get students to a conversation they might not need, or that they do need, but they might not have otherwise come to. And so I would just come back to this idea. Yes, I think there's an integration happening. The research university is a great place to see this integration happening, but we have to be very careful with language, because as soon as we talk about religion and science in the West, it's usually framed as creationism versus evolution. It's a very myopic framing of what I think are two approaches to the same question of consciousness and existence.
And you mentioned the data sets that you're creating for your research students to use. How much of those data sets are empirical? I'm thinking of things like sleep hours is obviously quite obvious, easy to calculate, but things like joy and feeling of being uplifted and those, you know, subconscious type things. How would you empiricize those?
You know, it is a lot of well-being is self-reported, but that's fine because that is how you feel, right? If I'm reporting to you that I feel anxious, it means I feel anxious. Our well-being is how we feel. So it has to be self-reported. And I think the important thing is just the metric that when you start the class, you as a person might feel X. And when you end the class, you as a person might feel Y. You yourself are self-reporting the whole time, but because you yourself have seen that journey, you can see how these tools might be helpful. And so when you're talking about well-being for young people, there is no objective measure. It is subjective because it is self-reported. But I don't think we should demonize self-reporting. Our experience of the world is inherently subjective. If we feel like we're flourishing, we are. And if we feel like we're not, we're not. It doesn't matter what the world tells us. It matters what we feel.
Interesting.
There was a comment made by Phil Goldberg, one of our esteemed guests, in a recent minute or a special that we've recorded. He said that there was, I think, 6 hours, correct me if I'm wrong on this, guys, but I think he said there were 6 hours of content in the documentary that was cut down to, I think it's, I really should know this, I think an hour and a half.
80 minutes, yeah.
80 minutes, okay, thanks. What in those 6 hours was yours, Vernon, and what would you maybe, looking back, have wanted maybe to include in there?
Yeah, it's a good question. I honestly can't even remember what was included because it's been so long. So honestly, we did this 5 or 6 years ago, so I don't remember the specific details. But here's what I will say, and I hope this doesn't come out wrong. Here's what I will say. When you make a film, you are always looking for a good second act. The second act is where the film lives or die, in my opinion. It's the confrontation. So the first act is the introduction. The second act is the sort of tension. And the third act is the resolution. Every good film, every good documentary, life, every good story has these three acts. You set it up, there's some problem or confrontation or issue, and then it gets resolved. We had a really hard time finding the confrontation tension within Yogananda's life. We looked and looked and looked. This was an objective film. The filmmakers wanted to explore Yogananda's life, warts and all. It was not an apologetic film. It was not something to lionize someone. But for the life of me, I couldn't find anything. You know, like I couldn't find anything. And that's rare. You know, almost every Indian guru, Hindu guru who's come to the United States has had something negative that you could say. Many of them have behaved in ways that were completely unethical, or their organizations have behaved in ways that were completely unethical. I mean, look at what Yogananda did in the US, and then 30 years later, look at what Osho did in the US. These are two very different organizations, right? With Osho, Netflix was able to do a 6 or 10 part series because there was so much of the act two. And we couldn't find it. And so I think in that 6 hours, maybe some of it was looking for the warts and all, but I know from a filmmaking perspective, that was really difficult. And I think that gives the story a different kind of feel to it. It's not like a gotcha film. It's not like a knock them up and set them down film. It's an authentic film about an authentic person.
Do you use Awake as reading material for any of your suggested reading material for any of your classes or anything like that?
You know, I did, when we do the section on Hinduism in the US, I use Yogananda as one of our sort of topics to think through Hinduism in the US. Phil Goldberg comes in and does the guest lecture. I do assign stuff from his book, and then I assign the film as well. And so, and excerpts from Autobiography of a Yogi. So yes, I do use it. I mean, Autobiography of Yogi is just one of the great spiritual classics ever. I mean, I don't know how you rank these, but it's hard to think that it wouldn't be in the top five if you were to rank them. And by spiritual classic, I don't mean spiritual classic for Hindus. I mean spiritual classic for people, right? This is one of those books like The Alchemist where it doesn't matter what tradition you're from, you can probably see part of yourself in this, which is crazy because it's the first kind of firsthand account of a mystic I ever read. You know, when you're talking about teleportation or ideas of communicating across space and time or meeting 500-year yogis, it's hard to think that, oh yeah, everyone who reads this will get something out of it because it seems fantastical. But there's something so human about it, right? That it's no wonder why it's moved so many people. At the end of the day, the Autobiography of a Yogi is the living guru for this SRF Foundation. This is the way people encounter Yogananda today. And so it's no wonder that it's had the influence that it's had across space and time. And I think after the movie came out, like sales of the book exponentially increased. And so that's what I love about what you're doing. The movie drove people to the book. The podcast will drive people to the book. We need to do what we can in this day and age to shine a light on Yogananda. And the best way to do that is through the autobiography of a yogi.
Yeah, absolutely. The reason I asked though is because in this age of instant knowledge, instant gratification, instant, you know, there, no one wants to, well, very few people want to read a 30-something chapter book.
It's true.
But 1.5 hour
film. But
that's
why we have a podcast, right? That's why you have the podcast.
But 1.5 hour film. I mean, yeah. I can imagine like students would do that one, you know, before an exam. They'd be like, okay, let's just get that's a quick.
Listen, 5 or 6 years ago, a 1.5 hour film was digestible. Now I think you need like a 20-second TikTok video, honestly, because the attention span is gone. People say that the movie theaters won't survive because of COVID. I think movie theaters won't survive because people don't have the attention span anymore to sit through a movie without checking their phone. If you're watching a movie at home, you've got your phone, you've got your iPad, and you're like 3 or 4 different screens. Who now can go and sit for 90 minutes without reaching for their phone? Especially during COVID, where we've become so tethered. So I think that the attention span is, has changed in a way that we need short form content, to really push this out. You would find it to be, if you had a TikTok, I've never been on TikTok, so I don't really know what I'm talking about. But if you had a TikTok channel where you pushed out one quote from Yogananda every day, you would probably have as much impact on spreading his message as anything you could do right now in the world to promote Yogananda.
Food for thought, Varun, because we're doing I'm doing a lot of social media things for our local center here. That's definitely food for thought.
Short form content. That's my suggestion.
Varun, I know we promised a 1 hour cutoff point today, so I want to be mindful of that and just kind of flag that to the guys and offer up some questions to kind of round off this conversation, because it's been really, really enjoyable. And I want to thank you again. And if I can just jump in, I'm sure you guys probably have enough questions to last another hour or two, to be fair. But you mentioned some of the things that you're doing. You did accomplish last year, which sounded fantastic, 10,000 people to join the mindfulness classes that you did during COVID, which is pretty epic. What are some of the things you're doing and working on in 2021 and beyond that you can promote?
So we see the crisis of our campus and really of our country as a crisis of belonging. I said the UK and also Japan also recognize that loneliness is a public health crisis. That if you're extremely lonely, it's the equivalent of smoking 15 cigarettes a day, that it's a predictor of premature death, et cetera, that it causes stress, which causes inflammation, which causes disease. And so we're focused on this idea of loneliness. And so instead of bringing in a director of loneliness, because no one wants to go to the loneliness class, we reframed it and we just appointed a director of belonging. And so her sort of job is to think about what it does it mean to belong on a campus of 50,000 students representing 150 different countries. And so we're doing all sorts of stuff. We have classes on friendship. We have these things called campfire conversations where you just meet with friends. You put your phones in the center. There's an app which creates a campfire on your phone. So it's like you're sitting around a crackling campfire, but you don't have to go through the fire marshal. And so and the phone is out of your hand and you have a conversation about something meaningful or important. Essentially, all I'm trying to do at this point in time is bring people together in intimate community. I'm trying to make a big place feel small. And I think that's going to be especially important in the fall. In the fall, everyone is super stoked to be back together. Everyone missed each other. But we have to go through a rehumanization process. It's not going to be easy for students to be back on campus in a dorm room less than 6 feet apart from someone, in the Coliseum with 100,000 football fans cheering, in a classroom with 300 other students. It's not going to be easy for professors. It's not going to be easy for me to go back to the office and take off my shorts and put on pants. Like, it's not gonna be easy for any of us, right? And so I think we have to temper as universities these two trends. One is this total excitement of being back, and the other is the absolute discomfort of relearning how to be human and social again. And so I think the fall will be a time of real distress, actually, people are going to come back to campus thinking this is the solution to the global plague I've gone through. This is the end of the nightmare. And they get to school and they feel lonely and disconnected and depressed and anxious, because that's what school makes people feel these days. And then they're going to internalize it. Oh, I'm supposed to be living my dream, but I'm living a nightmare, and it must be me because everyone else is happy. And so I'm actually concerned about the fall. And I think it's going to be a difficult process of rehumanization. And we just have to be really aware with young people that we're messaging that it's going to be tough, and it's okay that it's tough.
I have a question that's slightly unrelated, but you I read a few times that you are like the only dean of religious life in America that is Hindu. Do you feel like this is like a gauge of how far we are as like an interfaith culture? And does this have a special meaning to you?
Oh, Varun is muted.
Yeah, I think he has to step away. Sorry, Frank, go ahead.
Sorry, it's just phone. When it happened, I do feel like it was a moment. So I was hired in 2008. I became the first Hindu, and I was the only non-Christian to be the chief religious leader of American university in American history. Normally, you would have to be an ordained Protestant minister, but USC thought outside the box and hired me, a non-ordained Hindu attorney, which is a very different approach. But I got to say, it was 2008. And there was hope and change in the air. And Barack Obama just got the nomination for president at the time where I was a candidate. And it was in the zeitgeist. And suddenly all the things that had worked against me my whole life, being too young, having a funny name, being Hindu, not Christian, not being ordained, all the things that had worked against me in that one moment worked for me, right? And so I would like to think that this was a time of change. But in the 12 years since I have been appointed, there've been dozens of other university chaplains and deans of religious life who have been appointed. And there's been no other Hindu, there's been no other Muslim, there's been one Buddhist, and that's it. And so I don't think it actually was a precursor of things to come. I think I was the anomaly. Now there's a moment right now. We're going through a racial reckoning moment where we're talking a lot about white sort of supremacy. My hope is that we also talk about Christian hegemony too, and think about what kind of messages we're telling young people that, yes, we have to be inclusive, we have to be pluralistic, we have to be diverse, we have to be, you know, woke, but if you're not Christian, you can't lead. That, to me, doesn't seem that woke, quite frankly. And so I think what's really important is that I am the chaplain who happens to be Hindu. I am not the Hindu chaplain. I have Hindu chaplains on my campus, Christian chaplains, Muslim chaplains, but I am the chaplain for everyone. I happen to be Hindu. To me, that was the unique thing. I wasn't being hired as a Hindu chaplain. I was being hired as the university chaplain. And the fact that I was Hindu didn't preclude me from that.
Epic. Varun, I think we're out of time for today, and we'll respect your time. So I think I'll speak on behalf of everybody, but thank you very much for joining us today. And you know, keep in touch. We'd love to see what you're doing this year and in the years to come. So I'll say to Mike Priyank, if you have any last sort of comments, questions, anything you would want to add, Mike.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming on and for sharing your perspective on this. It's very interesting on how. Because we were also part of the young adults group in the London Center, and I feel like the experiences we had with young people were interesting. A lot of people were looking for belonging, and all the things you said, they resonated so much with me. So thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, for me, I've got a gazillion questions, which I think will probably be best answered if I take some of Varun's classes. So now I need to work out how to get myself to USC. Thank you so much, Varun. It's been absolutely fantastic having you.
Thank you, gentlemen. It's been a great morning for me. I wish I could wake up to this kind of conversation every day. So thank you.
For now.